Thank you very much, Professor Malevsky. It's a blessing and a curse to be a speaker late in the day at a conference like this. The blessing is that a lot of people have already started saying what I'm going to say, and the curse is that a lot of people have already said what I'm going to say. And if you're really unlucky, they've already told you jokes too. So, I need to go backwards. Okay, so this is a quote from Christina Stead, who says that a speculator is a man who, if he dies at the right time, has a rich widow. And I think maybe the person who wrote the New York Times article that Raymond read had read Christina Stead's novel, House of All Nations. The focus that we have this afternoon, of course, is asset allocation and mortality. And with Jeff Kingston and I have been looking at these issues as part of an ongoing project into risk management of retirement savings, particularly in the contribution, defined contribution fund context, which is of interest to us in Australia. The quote's a good one, though, because it emphasises the key issue in our paper, which is timing. That is, good timing as it relates to asset allocation decisions and consumption decisions for retirees under uncertain lifetimes. And the main point of our paper, which of course was originally made by Professor Malevsky and Professor Young, is that if you're looking into annuitisation, an asset allocation decision that is irreversible means that getting the timing right can affect your welfare. And buying an annuity is one such decision where it's important to get the timing right. But hopefully if we do some careful thinking, we may be able to time it a bit better than Christina Stead's speculator. Okay, so the annuitisation puzzle has been covered by quite a number of people this afternoon, particularly by Kristen. I'm going to try and focus on some issues that we haven't looked at already. Then we're going to look at the option to delay annuitisation as it was presented in the original paper by Malevsky and Young, which assumes constant relative risk aversion preferences. And fortunately for me, Francesco has also reviewed some of the issues related to HARA utility in his model. So that'll save me a bit of explaining when I get to the extension that we've been building on the original Malevsky and Young model. And of course we'll finish with the usual numerical examples. One of the most important financial decisions that we all face is this portfolio of assets for retirement that's been most of our focus today. What we hope to do is generate a long-term stream of discretionary spending, but we've got to deal with the uncertainties of asset returns and the uncertainties of our lifetimes. If we live too long, of course, we exhaust our assets, too short, and we have too many rich widows. As Kristen noted, since Yari first adapted the life cycle model to allow for risk, longevity risk, that is, he established that people in general should be willing to exchange their wealth for a life annuity because of the mortality pooling benefits. That's the theory, but of course what we observe in practice is entirely different. Voluntary annuitisation around the world is consistently weak and unpopular. Now there's a list of the usual suspects up there as to why this might be the case, and some of those were flagged this morning. I thought Malcolm's comments about shocks to health that have been raised again by our discussant just a few minutes ago were particularly interesting. And in the Australian context, we found that the government social security provisions also seem to be quite important. Some people have noted that the provision of annuities can be quite expensive because of loadings, though some more recent research has been casting doubt on that, and of course there's adverse selection. So defined benefit pension schemes typically have included a compulsory annuitisation component, but what we're seeing, as Kristen noted earlier, is as the population and the workforce in the developing world ages more rapidly, more and more pension systems are shifting towards the defined contribution schemes, which entails a greater emphasis on individual risk bearing and much less emphasis on pooling mortality risk. Australia is actually an interesting example of a country with very low levels of voluntary annuitisation. So before the early 1990s, Australian retirement incomes policy really only had two parts. The first part was a government-provided, means-tested age pension. It's fairly similar in structure to the Canadian Old Age Security, but a little bit more generous and more strictly means tested. In addition to that, there were voluntary retirement savings, and that was it. There was not, and there still isn't in Australia, any universal earnings-related publicly provided retirement income stream. There's nothing like the Canada Pension Plan in the Australian system. So in the 90s, the Australian government started to take a look at the ageing population and our retirement income scheme there, and they introduced a system which some of you would be familiar with called the superannuation guarantee, under which 9% of every worker's gross income is paid into an individually managed and privately managed account, which are fairly similar to registered retirement savings plans or 401ks, but perhaps there are a few more restrictions applied to them. So at retirement, the worker can withdraw their accumulation that they've gathered under the superannuation guarantee, and they've got a choice about what they do. They can spend their lump sum, or they can buy into some of these lifetime or term income stream products. So there are three types of income streams which I've put up there for you. As I said, there's the age pension, which is universal and means tested and basically provided for out of government tax revenue. If you meet the means testing, you can receive an age pension. And in Australia presently, 80% of people of eligible age do receive at least a part age pension, though far fewer receive a full age pension. In addition, you can buy a lifetime or term annuity, a fixed annuity, which are tax preferred. There are regulatory incentives to encourage people to take up fixed annuities. Or you can buy into an allocated pension, which is a phased withdrawal product. So if you buy a life annuity, you're going to exchange your capital for an income stream over your remaining lifetime. But clearly you can't retrieve that capital, and you can't enjoy the benefits of an unexpectedly good year on the stock exchange. By contrast, if you buy an allocated pension, you transfer your savings into a fairly well-diversified, usually, investment fund, and you accept uncertain returns. The drawdown out of these allocated pensions is regulated between upper and lower limits, but there are no guarantees over income, and there's certainly no risk pooling in an allocated pension account. But one of the attractive features are that people can withdraw their capital, allocated pensions are commutable, or they can reallocate their assets among different asset classes according to their tastes. So what do they do? This graph shows sales of pensions and annuities of different types in Australia since 1989. So what you can see here is that despite the fact that the regulators have introduced lots of social security and tax incentives to try to encourage people to take annuities, they don't. They much prefer the phased withdrawal product, which is indicated there by the tall brown lines. The tiny light pink square that you can barely see is the proportion of longevity insurance that's actually being sold in the Australian annuities market. It's always been the least popular product, and that's the case at the moment. What's more, when people do choose this phased withdrawal option, we see that they actually still want to keep a consistently high level of exposure to risky assets. So here's an average asset class allocation for a phased withdrawal product, and you can see there that more than half of it is invested in equities and property, which are relatively risky. So clearly, people, despite the regulated incentives, do not voluntarily choose longevity insurance, and they want to maintain exposure to the stock market and control over their capital. So if you've read, and I'm sure many of you have read, Malevsky and Young's work on the option to delay annuitisation, these choices by Australian retirees will probably come as no surprise to you. According to the literature on optimal inertia, there are three factors that we need to create a situation in which delaying an investment might be optimal. Firstly, the investment has to have some feature of irreversibility. The environment needs to have some ongoing uncertainty that generates information that's relevant to the investment decision. And finally, the investment opportunity can't disappear if it's not taken up immediately. Now, Malevsky and Young recognise the connection between these three characteristics and a retiree who's got to make a decision about buying an annuity. Clearly, the purchase of annuity can't be renegotiated, so there's a sunk cost involved in that. The environment in the model setup, as you'll see shortly, is uncertain because each period receives information about competing financial assets period by period, which can potentially increase his or her wealth. And clearly you can delay the purchase of annuity even though the terms of the purchase price will change as you keep on delaying. So just to briefly recap the Malevsky and Young model, they use the basic standard Merton 1969 setup, which has one risk-free and one risky asset under constant relative risk aversion. Those of you who are familiar with this model will know that it generates a constant mix asset allocation strategy and a smooth consumption path. However, they introduce two interesting variations to the standard model. The first one is that they assume that the investor faces each instant a time-varying but known probability of survival, which may or may not be the same as the probability used to price the annuities. This is the same method as Kristen used in her paper. So what we get is the advantage of distinguishing between people's opinions on their own survival probability and the opinion of the market as it's priced into the annuity product. Secondly, they enforce on the model a decision in which the investor can at one point in their remaining lifetime irreversibly switch all of their wealth into a fixed annuity, which is fairly priced if you agree with the market's prediction on survival probabilities. And what they find is that solving this model for the best time to annuitize produces, in my opinion, some very interesting results. They demonstrate that the instant of retirement clearly may not be the best time to annuitize. The reason for this is that switching into annuity closes off your chance of improving your wealth by continued exposure to the risky asset. And keeping alive in an investment in the stock market can make you wealthy with a sufficiently high probability that postponement becomes the best option. But I thought just as interesting was their conclusion about the impact of the divergence about opinions on survival probabilities. So in the past, many analyses of annuitization have mistakenly concentrated only on individuals who viewed themselves as less healthy than average. And as we've already noted today, these people are not likely to buy an annuity that's priced on population mortality rates. It simply won't offer you a high enough rate of consumption if you're planning to die quickly. But Malevsky and Young showed that there is an incentive to delay annuitization not only if you're not very healthy, but also if you view yourself as more healthy than average. Because living longer gives you the chance to increase your wealth by investing in the risky asset for longer. In fact, they demonstrate that any disagreement about mortality rates can, between the provider and the purchase of annuity, can result in a delay. So we looked at these results, and we looked at the choices that Australian retirees were making, and we decided to try and extend the model because we'd been working with the HARA model that Francesco outlined for us earlier. And we thought maybe there were some advantages that this might help line up, both generalize the preference structure a little and line the model up a bit with policy and practice. So we noted that the work that I've just outlined used constant relative risk aversion preferences. Hyperbolic absolute risk aversion preferences, or HARA, measures utility relative, in our case, to a consumption floor. Francesco was looking at a future pension value, we're looking at a consumption floor. We're assuming that people are interested not in their absolute level of consumption, but in how their consumption varies above some subsistence level. Now, the advantage of doing this is that it means that HARA investors exhibit decreasing relative risk aversion as consumption deviates away from the floor. And since Merton's 1979 model, the allocation and consumption results under this assumption have been well known. Now, there are some advantages for trying to use this preference pattern. The first one is that most discussions of welfare in retirement are usually couched in terms of replacement rates. Not only that, salary-style rules are often used in financial planning guides to help people work out what they think they're going to need to maintain their welfare in retirement. So if you go to, for example, the Canadian Government Human Resources site, then it gives you that standard 70% of your current earnings rule as a guide to your retirement welfare. Now, we've had some discussion today about the validity or otherwise of those approaches to welfare, but that's one thing that the HARA model does. It lets us link into that fairly directly. Secondly, the HARA model is the simplest case of a consumption habit. You would know consumption habit models from studies into the equity premium puzzle. We're assuming that our consumption habits are well formed by retirement, that they're constant in this case. But, for example, switching to an external consumption habit might not cost you too much. Thirdly, the original Merton model showed that people who are concerned about consumption floors respond to their asset allocation decision by creating an extra fund in the risk-free asset. As Francesco pointed out, the costs to falling below the floor are infinite in utility terms. So what you have to do if you've got these type of preferences is guard all your future consumption levels by allocating a larger quantity to the risk-free asset. That protects all future consumption floors, and then you can invest the remainder of your wealth, your cushion wealth, into either the risky or risk-free assets according to your tastes and according to predictions about returns. When you use this strategy, you actually replicate portfolio insurance behavior, and that's one of the motivations also we have for looking at this type of model. So when we extend the Malevsky and Young analysis to the Hara case, we find, not surprisingly, that concern about a consumption floor shifts forward the optimal time to switch into an annuity. So it hasn't really helped us solve our problem with the Australian retirement incomes market, because the effect is similar to raising the level of relative risk aversion in a constant relative risk aversion model. However, as you'll see later, the move to this more general preference structure has cost us something in terms of analytical precision. Before we consider the model, before we get to the math, it's late in the day, I thought you might enjoy this comment on mortality and mathematicians. But maybe your pores are feeling a bit clogged from the earthy particles blown from the dusty highway of vulgar life, to which we all must return shortly. Maybe Hippocrates is perhaps a bit more to your taste when it comes to math. I must say, this time of day. Okay, so bear with me while I quickly run through the model setup. You've seen a lot of this already this afternoon. So we've got one risky asset, standard geometric Brownian motion, nothing clever happening with time here at all. We've got a risk-free asset and the same actuarial present value of a life annuity as Kristen showed in her model. Just to remind you that TPX is probability that person aged X will live another T periods. Now notice that there are two hazard rates relevant to the calculation in this model. The subjective factor, which is the agent's own opinion about how likely they are to survive, and the objective factor. We've made a profound contribution to the literature by changing the superscript from Kristen's model and the original Malevsky and Young model. So just to confuse you, we've marked the subjective factor superscript B and the objective factor superscript O. Right. We'll start at the back. After you annuitize, you get a flat consumption stream indicated by CT in this model, which is your wealth at the moment of annuitization, capital T, dependent on the annuitization factor that's given by the market. So when we combine this with the Hara utility function here at the bottom, where C hat is our floor level of consumption, we can't fall below that level, at time capital T, this gives us a boundary condition that we can use in solving the pre-annuitization problem. So this is what it looks like. At time zero, the agent's problem is to determine, make contingent plans for CT, the consumption path, pi T, which is simply the proportion of wealth allocated to the risky asset, and capital T, which is the date at which you switch into an annuity, subject to the usual wealth constraint. Okay. Now to solve the problem, we have to construct a value function, which is that long expression at the top there, which assumes that the annuitization date is given. It's at this point, bear with me, that the differences between the constant relative risk aversion and the Hara model start to cut in. Okay, now you recall a few minutes ago I said that the Hara agent responds to their consumption floor by setting aside a fund in the risk-free asset. That expression there next to W hat is the fund that's needed to guard the consumption floor. The first term is the amount you need before the date of annuitization, and the second term covers it after the date of annuitization. So what we do is redefine the state variable as cushion wealth, as the difference between your actual wealth and W hat, and do similar with the consumption path, and this allows us to rewrite the wealth constraint in terms of cushion wealth. So this allows us to set up the HJB equation. We use the boundary condition, and the solution comes out reasonably neatly in terms of cushion wealth. Okay. So the differences between the analysis here on the constant relative risk aversion and higher utility is probably easiest if we just have a look at the annuitization conditions. So here we've gone to the point where time is at capital T, we are at the instant of annuitization, and we've allowed the subjective and objective probabilities of survival to be equal. Okay, basically, a positive consumption fall brings forward the best time to switch into an annuity. The top expression, which is the original one in the Malevsky and Young paper, shows us that if there is no flaw, the retiree simply compares the risk-adjusted expected return to stocks, which here is indicated by delta, the expression at the bottom, and the change in the value of the annuity as measured by the change in the hazard rate as you age. So delay is best in this case whenever the benefits of a risky investment outweigh the boost to annuity value for the rising hazard rate. Now, by contrast, because the HARA agent is insuring all future consumption, he's much more heavily exposed to the risk-free asset, which gives us the ratio in the expression W hat T over W tilde T. Now, because they're more heavily invested in the risk-free asset, they have much less potential to benefit from exposure to the risky asset, and this reduces the option value in delaying annuitization. Now, the second important feature that we need to note here is the presence of stochastic wealth in the annuitization condition. This means that up to the instant of annuitization in this model, the solution is approximate. So the agent has to form an expectation of their future wealth and approximate their annuitization date. Now, recall that they have an asset allocation that's horizon dependent. So this means that as new information flows in, they've got to constantly revise their expectations, constantly think about what their annuitization date might be, and then review their asset allocation process. So you've got a very changeable model compared with the one under constant relative risk aversion preferences. If you're looking for some analogies in the literature, I think Sundaresan and Zapatero's 1997 paper on the option value to retire uses a similar approach to working out their problem. Okay, if you like the pictures better, the effect of ensuring a consumption floor is perhaps more clearly seen in this graph. So as we age, the force of mortality increases. This graph doesn't depict the Gompertz-Makem force of mortality, which we actually use in the calculations a bit later. So as we age, eventually we reach the point where it becomes optimal to switch out of the risky asset and into the life annuity. So what happens when we insure a consumption floor is basically we lower the hurdle. So the consumption floor means that we switch out of the risky asset into the life annuity at an earlier date. Numerically speaking, how much might this consumption floor matter in terms of bringing forward an optimal annuitization date? This table shows some numerical examples of how an optimal annuitization date might change under alternative forecasts of risky asset returns. If I'd known about the Siegel and Arnott debate, I would have used their alternatives, but we're a bit slow sometimes in Sydney. So you might remember a few years ago the Investment Forum published two perspectives on future asset returns, and we've used these in our calculations. The conservative predictions on the left belong to John Campbell, and the more optimistic predictions on the right belong to Roger Ibbotson. So you can see that if you're insuring 50% of your consumption floor, have a look at the bottom row, this will bring forward your annuitization date by between 5 and 6 years based on our predictions of mortality and these measures of the Sharpe ratio. So a moderately risk-averse man, for example, might not delay annuitizing at all. But what we do see is that putting off annuitization will be better for those who are planning to live longer, for the more risk-tolerant, and for the more optimistic. Now, I haven't got any numerical examples to show you on the question of divergent mortality beliefs, but there's a section in our paper which shows that the Malevsky and Young result holds for the HARA case as well. So divergent beliefs about mortality will encourage delay. So in conclusion, what we see is that people don't like voluntarily annuitizing, and that's certainly true in Australia. since widespread individual pension accounts have been introduced, we observe that people do actually want to keep their options open and they like exposure to the risky asset market. So what we have done here in extending this model is found that protecting a consumption floor might be one reason for bringing forward your date of annuitization. Now, clearly, it would be nice to know more about asset allocation paths, and we hope that eventually we can do some numerical estimation of the pre-annuitization paths and be able to say something about that. And this model looks like it's born to be partially annuitized. So hopefully that's something that we can also look forward to doing in the future. Finally, I'd like to give you a 5-second virtual holiday at the sea bars at Coogee Beach. These are about 2 kilometres away from the campus at the University of New South Wales, where Jeff and I work. And it's a good place to be, and we like visitors. So do consider coming to see us sometime too.